Mr. Is it Kostak?
Excuse me, it's Ostike, Your Honor.
Ostike.
May please the court, I am Scott Ostike, representing the Physician Hospitals of America and Texas Spine and Joint Hospital Limited. Your Honors, we're here to discuss Section 6001 of the Affordable Care Act. I know that law has gotten considerable treatment in Washington. We're here on a very narrow slice of it. But we're here with concerns equivalent to many others who have looked at the law. Ours concerns a grant of summary judgment that was rendered against us in the district court. Our specific concerns are that in the opinion issued by the district judge, there were several checkpoints that we identified that the Supreme Court has identified that are in the direction of lower courts when they're considering constitutional questions that arise because of statutory implementation. We believe that the district judge did not properly either treat those checkpoints because he found limiting law that we don't think was correctly applied that made them inapplicable in his facts, or because of the fact that he just didn't find them relevant and didn't therefore find them material to his assessment of our facts. We accept the district judge's decision and his, the way he laid it out in his opinion about the fact that legislative facts are different than adjudicative facts. We know the standard about how a statute is defended and how the Department of Justice has the ability to project forward what's going to happen. But there's not an adequate record before Your Honors because of the fact that we raised four checkpoints that weren't adequately treated in the development of the case. The first one I want to discuss is retroactivity. The reason is because the court, in its interim decision issued to give guidance to counsel about an impending trial, indicated that Section 6001 of the Affordable Care Act was in fact retroactive, but not unconstitutionally so. When the opinion came out, the court said it wasn't retroactive because it had an implementation date of March 23, 2010, which, by way of background, this provision, Section 6001, was one of the only provisions of the Affordable Care Act that was immediately implemented. As you know, the arguments in Washington earlier this week concerned parts of whether or not the law was even ripe for adjudication because there had not been yet imposed penalty under the individual mandate. This provision was immediately applicable to anybody who was a doctor and owned a hospital. And as the record established, without contradiction, there were 100 hospitals that were owned by physicians that were under development at the time of the implementation of Section 6001. The report, the conference report on this law, also indicated that there was between $4 and $5 billion invested by physician owners in the development of these 100 facilities. And as the district court readily admitted, the effect of Section 6001 was to shut down on a dime the development of all those hospitals because the income stream in that development was acknowledged by the district court to have been from Medicare reimbursement, meaning when a senior patient brings their patient choice to our hospitals that are doctor-owned in fraction, and then when they seek services there, those services are between doctor-patient, the reimbursement of which, because Medicare is a usurping statute, it governs the insurance of all people who require senior care, and that's 60% of lifetime care is in the later years. So the government has taken that care, has usurped that insurance program, and has told the patient, you can seek out your hospital of choice. When they seek out a hospital owned by a doctor, they have to then, under 6001, expansion of that facility is no longer allowed as of the moment of that law because of the fact that the income stream for that hospital was established and acknowledged by the district court and Congress to be between 48% and 90% Medicare reimbursement dependent.
So the assumption of your argument is you have some type of right. What right do you have to Medicare benefits?
Well, we have the obligation to treat our patient. And our patient comes in with a program that has been federally determined, Medicare, to be a reimbursement program federally established. So the payment for our services, which, again, the record is that between 48% and 90% of all doctors operating in these specialty hospital models are under Medicare reimbursement.
You know, in all of these arguments, you know, you look at, you listen to the arguments, and, you know, at a level of generality, it all makes sense. But when you get down to specifics, and it seems to me the specifics here is self-referral, Medicare, and whether or not there's some type of property interest that you have, some type of interest that is cognizable by this court, that you can, that we can protect, that the court can protect or the law protects. And that's the assumption that you're not articulating.
Thank you, Judge. Let me get into my four checkpoints, because I think each has a different, and I understand your concern. The first checkpoint is retroactivity. The district judge, as I indicated, first thought this is retroactive, then said it's not, because of the fact that the date is March 23rd, 2010, when the law was passed. But the Supreme Court has articulated clearly that retroactivity in effect is just as damaging as the way you write a statute. In fact, Justice Scalia said that only, I think his quote was, stupid staff would write a statute that on its face barred some form of prospective implementation. The point being that you have to look at the effect of a law in addition to what it says. And Congress conceded that there were $4 billion tied up in the investment in these development hospitals. Congress knew, as did the district court, that it would stop them on a dime. So the reality is, what is the settled transactions? What are those development expectations? District court found that it takes years to develop a hospital. So the question is, from the Supreme Court jurisprudence, were we protected in the implementation of this law? The district court had a duty under Supreme Court jurisprudence not just to determine if there was an effect of retroactivity, which he didn't at all by calling it prospective, but secondly, the government had the duty to explain to the district court why retroactivity in effect was necessary for the implementation of the statute.
All right, but Judge Garza's question, as I heard it, was what interest of yours is protected? Is it a property interest? What is the interest that you're asserting here that's being deprived, a constitutional interest?
Well, this is clearly, as we explained to the district court, a real estate regulation. Because the law is set up to regulate hospital beds, it targets only hospital beds. It says you can't expand them after March 23rd if your hospital self-refers Medicare patients. By the way, all specialty hospitals self-refer. The model that they targeted was specialty hospitals. It's a defined term in the district court opinion. Specialty hospitals in America are half owned by doctors, half owned by corporate and community interests. The model is the same, it operates the same. The record also indicates that all doctors self-refer Medicare patients across all ownership models. That's not a phenomenon unique to doctor-owned hospitals, it exists in every area. So the issue, on the retroactivity that we were concerned about was, in the property interest is what I was explaining. Because you regulate a bed, and a bed is on a floor, and a floor is on a footing, and a footing is affixed to land, what you've basically done is you've said, this piece of property cannot be developed in the way in which...
Let's see if we can move on from this level of generality. It seems to me that Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries have an interest. I'm not sure that you can carry that interest to the physicians who may own these type of facilities per se, as a Fifth Amendment type of argument. And in your brief, it just doesn't seem to me that you've articulated again. It doesn't prevent you from using this particular hospital. That's number one. Number two, other doctors can use this particular hospital if they're not owners. And it seems to me, in a general sense, there has been an articulated reason, a reasonable articulation of a reason why these self-referrals should not be compensated by Medicare. But I've not, I still have not heard from you what this, you know, where you get this interest is either in property or constitutional interest that's protected here.
We have the right under due process not to be retroactively legislated out of our investment. That's under retroactivity. Clearly, the due process standard indicates, and Your Honors, because I found it particularly enlightening, we looked at the two-step analysis that's required under that provision. The court said that you have to, and this is in pension benefit guarantee versus Gray, which we cited. Court says the retroactive aspects of legislation, as well as the prospective aspects, must meet the test of due process, and the justifications for the latter may not suffice for the former. But that burden is met simply by showing that the retroactive application of the legislation is itself justified by a rational legislative purpose.
And so let's, why it seems to me that there has been at least a rational explanation of why self-referrals for Medicaid payments should be excluded, okay, by the statute. Now, tell me why that's unreasonable or not rational.
Because to do it retroactively meant that $4 billion in hospital development that was coming online was taken away from the investors who had put the $4 billion up at risk in order to build these hospital expansions.
So you could never change the statute because always somebody is building or doing something that will have a retroactive effect. It just seems to me that as I understand it, and I'm reading from the briefs only, but there was a grandfather clause and an opportunity to comply and before the statute to get approval. Prior to the effective date to get some type of approval, but also to get some type of exemption after the effective date, as I understand.
Thank you, Judge.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think that, first of all, there was no grandfathering as to new construction for existing Medicare providers. The law passed March 23rd. As of that date, you could not expand.
Okay.
That was for people who already had a Medicare exemption. If you were new to the field and you were applying for your Medicare exemption in order to get this hospital, for one reason or another, they gave you 10 months. Some speculation was it had to do with a couple members in California who had hospitals under development in their district and had not yet reached their Medicare. There became a carve-out. So there became a second test if you don't yet have your Medicare certification. If you did, like the core client, Texas Spine and Joint Hospital, if you were like North Cypress Hospital 30 miles from here that has four OR beds that are built but can't be used because they were not ready to come online before March 23rd, 2010, they're dark. There's 100 other hospitals implicated by this.
There's no doubt that this had a devastating effect on certain physician-owned hospitals. No doubt about that. The question, it seems to me, is do you have a right that should have been protected? And you're saying that this is that the retroactivity lacked the constitutional process necessary.
You had the right to have a process that explained to you, as the language I quoted to you from Gray requires, why the government did this retroactively, and that was never done by the district judge because he denied that this was retroactive in effect. So we had no analysis of the point, no analysis of the issue, no rational basis for retroactivity, given everybody knew these hospitals were under development and they exempted some. Then the second point was the arbitrariness point. The court dealt with that by saying, well, under Williams versus Lee Optical, you can basically eat the problem one bite at a time. So we had raised the fact that there was no study, there was no censure, no sanction against other members of the specialty hospital model, which were the community and corporate interests, but only the doctor owns. So you can be a plumber and own a hospital, but you can't be a doctor and own a hospital under this financing formula, which the district court found to be determinative. There was no quibble in district court about whether you could finance this hospital without this Medicare provision. That was established in the evidence. So the question was, is that arbitrary? When you take similar models, especially hospital model, and you deal with them in this way. And the court, frankly, didn't have an answer for that.
Well, I thought, whether the court did or not, I thought it was there was the self-interest. The statute seems to want to protect against self-interest and the increase in the number of procedures in the physician-owned hospitals. I thought that was one of the rationales.
Nowhere in the record, though, in our arbitrariness point, was it established that this practice that goes across all specialty hospitals was any more repugnant or any more present in physician-owned ones versus ones where doctors work on contract, self-refer patients, and are compensated that way. So our arbitrariness point was you've got to look at least under the hood.
Communities and corporate entities cannot self-refer. If doctors are independent contractors, at least in the state of Texas they are, and it just seems to me that if a corporation owns a hospital or the community owns a hospital, doctors are distinct and separate from that, and so the same model that is imposed on physicians is horribly dissimilar from your situation.
Our evidence at trial that was proffered in affidavits was going to be that physician compensation is determined across the board in some way, shape, or form based on your patient load. And because of the fact that it's a found federal fact that the large majority of those patients do come about in Medicare because of self-referral, it was axiomatic that therefore compensation across the board was so figured. I'll return, Your Honor, to address.
Yes,
point.
You've saved time for rebuttal, Mr. Ostike. Thank you. And for the government, I'm going to ask you to pronounce your name for us, if you would.
Kerswan.
Kerswan? All right,
yes.
Ms. Kerswan. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Dana Kerswan for the United States. We've laid out the jurisdictional argument in our brief. I'm happy to answer any questions there, but I'd like briefly to explain why these claims are wholly meritless. This is a Medicare statute, as the Court has observed, that controls future federal spending. Congress can change that going forward at any time. The Supreme Court said that in Bowen. There's no protected interest to get Medicare money in the future, no protected interest under any of these social programs, the Supreme Court said in Selfie. And there's no taking when we're talking about a condition on participation in a voluntary federal program.
Let me ask you just something a little bit more basic. Does the Department of Justice recognize that federal courts have the authority in appropriate circumstances to strike federal statutes because of one or more constitutional infirmities?
Yes, Your Honor. Of course, there would need to be a severability analysis, but yes.
I'm referring to statements by the President in the past few days to the effect, and I'm sure you've heard about them, that it is somehow inappropriate for what he termed unelected judges to strike acts of Congress that have enjoyed, and he was referring, of course, to Obamacare, to what he termed a broad consensus and majorities in both houses of Congress. That has troubled a number of people who have read it as somehow a challenge to the federal courts or to their authority or to the appropriateness of the concept of judicial review, and that's not a small matter. So I want to be sure that you're telling us that the Attorney General and the Department of Justice do recognize the authority of the federal courts through unelected judges to strike acts of Congress or portions thereof in appropriate cases.
Marbury versus Madison is the law, Your Honor. But that would not make sense in this circumstance to strike down this statute.
All right,
because
I would like to have from you by noon on Thursday, that's about 48 hours from now, a letter stating what is the position of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice in regard to the recent statements by the President, stating specifically and in detail in reference to those statements, what the authority is of the federal courts in this regard in terms of judicial review. That letter needs to be at least 3 pages, single space, no less, and it needs to be specific. It needs to make specific reference to the president's statements and to the, again, the position of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice.
Okay, and that's our position regarding judicial review and the authority
judicial
of the court.
Judicial review as it relates to the specific statements of the president in regard to Obamacare and to the authority of the federal courts to review that legislation.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Now, in terms of the statute that is before the court in this case, of course, there's no basis for striking this statute down. Congress didn't need evidence, but of course they had evidence showing. They asked the Medicare Payment Advisory Committee to do a study. There was research from GAO and HHS that showed that these self-referrals lead to increased spending through higher costs and unnecessary procedures, just like the research showed with other physician-owned entities. And that they also undermine the system of handling emergencies and complex cases through community hospitals, even though these physician-owned hospitals depend on community hospitals. 66% are calling 911 to handle it when there's an emergency.
Now, counsel opposite says, well, wait a minute. The argument, you know, is defeats itself because self-referral applies across the board. What is the government's response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, the statute bans compensation agreements in hospitals that are based on referrals. That's 1-3.
Self-referrals.
Self-referrals going forward are out for these physician-owned hospitals. Any doctor whose compensation agreement is based on referring patients to the hospital, that is also not allowed. That's not new. That's been the rule for a long time. The research showed that there was a particular issue with these self-referrals that lead to higher costs and increased procedures.
This statute only added physician-owned hospitals. Self-referrals had already been a prohibition before that.
That's right, Your Honor. For example, the law previously applied to a large range of medical services, including a physician-owned hospital department. Self-referrals would not have been permitted there. In terms of the retroactivity argument, of course, under Bowen, Congress can change the Medicare statute. And as long as they aren't walking away from paying for past services, there's no retroactivity problem here. This is what they pay for in the future. Congress included a generous grandfathering clause that doesn't make the statute retroactive. And pension benefits says that it's not unlawful, a statute's not unlawful, solely because it upsets otherwise settled expectations.
What does the record tell us in this case was the status of this particular, I'll call it a project, or the expansion? Had there been investor money spent? Had there been money spent on planning? Had there been physical activity on the site in terms of digging or building? What was the status as of the effective date of the act?
My understanding, Your Honor, I don't want to misstate anything, so maybe this is also a question for plaintiff's counsel, but my understanding is they had purchased the land. They had gotten it rezoned for a hospital. Of course, nothing here changes that zoning designation. You can still put a hospital there. They had evicted the tenants, but they hadn't started construction. Now, of course, we can't have a situation where
I don't mean to interrupt you, and I understand you may not have full evidence of this, but it's important on retroactivity. So does the record reflect that there had been sufficient substantial investor activity in anticipation of the expansion?
I believe about $3 million had been spent. They're talking about a $37 million expansion. But even if Your Honor thinks that the retroactivity factors need to be applied in this situation, under Landsgraf, what we're looking about at is fair notice, reasonable reliance, and settled expectations. And you have fair notice that Congress can change the Medicare statute going forward. You don't have a reasonable expectation in that statute staying the same, because as the Supreme Court said in Bowen, that Congress has to be able to make changes so that it can spend its money in the way that it thinks is the most effective. So, also, of course, well, if there are no further questions, I ask the Court to affirm or to dismiss the case for lack of jurisdiction.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Kirschbaum. Mr. Hostag?
Yes,
thank you. Save time for rebuttal?
Yes. I'll answer the investment question. Texas Spine and Joint Hospital is our focal hospital. We wanted to make sure there was one live example that was actually located right in Tyler, Texas, where the district court was. So that example is the one referenced by the government, where $3 million had already been invested, including rezoning and including acquisition of property at a premium for the purposes of this expansion. Nobody would have bought these lots. They were too depressed to justify the price, but that was because of contiguous assignment. In terms of the notice issue, you know, doctor-owned hospitals were the original hospitals, and they never were regulated any differently until March 23rd, 2010, because there was always a whole hospital issue that allowed you to operate as a whole hospital, which these physician-owned hospitals do.
Counselor, it seems to me, I mean, all of us have asked you about this, but the point the government has, you still, in my mind, haven't overcome, which is all of this good business judgment, reasonable, all of that, but none of it's guaranteed when you're dealing with something like this government program. And if the government, for reasons, good reasons, bad reasons, can change how the system works. And some people, unfortunately, have been left holding a economically disadvantaged bag. Isn't that sort of all we're dealing with here?
Well, that's part of what we're dealing with. We're also dealing with the fact that a regulatory government has expanded to such large extents that these checkpoints are becoming more and more important. That's why the Supreme Court gave several days of oral argument in unprecedented fashion to the fact that one-sixth of the economy went under government control.
Well, is anything going to be decided in that case that we should wait for?
Well, yes, because the Affordable Care Act itself could be struck. We've asked Your
Honor.
There
is that.
I'm sorry?
There is that.
We asked Your Honor by on motion to defer this argument. I understand why these debates are very important and letters are very important, and we really do need to have these matters moved, because I've got people with investment capital, and we were seeking injunction. That's all we wanted. But in reality, if in fact the Affordable Care Act does not survive the Supreme Court scrutiny, Section 6001 goes with it, and back to Congress it is. So we do have a situation where we had asked Your Honors for stay. We do believe it's wise to defer until the Supreme Court has ruled, because if, in fact, the Affordable Care Act in its entirety is struck down, then 6001 goes with it.
Just by way of explanation, because I was actually just the one who denied that motion, but our court generally doesn't do that, because we found in the past that too often an issue that everyone thought might be decided by the Supreme Court isn't. And so as long as we have a case that's been set up by adequate briefing and it's not, for some reason, hugely inconvenient to go ahead and have the oral argument and submit the case, we found generally our experience is that we don't wait to see what the Supreme Court might do. It was not an unreasonable motion, but I just need to explain to you that I was the one who decided that, and that's the reason we did that. It's in accordance with our court's usual, not always, but our usual practice to go ahead and keep cases moving, and you've indicated there is a need for a decision on this from one court or another as soon as possible.
Yes, and we did take it in that spirit. We respect Your Honor's decision on that one. The last point I'll make has to do with the per se rule in Lucas, because we're in new times. The role of government and private sector in economic development, 100 hospitals built in partnership on a Medicare program that sorely needs their beds. It's not like the government wasn't encouraging private investment and bringing along the infrastructure, because all this infrastructure is where patient choice goes. Yeah. President Obama, in the articulation of this law, said patient choice won't be threatened.
Yeah, but in Lucas, it was a total prohibition of the use of that property.
We had that here, too. We bought property that we can't use for anything. In Lucas, they said you could picnic on it, and Judge Scalia scoffed at that. He said
you can have a hospital there. It just cannot have this self.
Your Honor's right, but we bought this property adjacent to our existing facility. Our facility was there. We amassed all this asset adjacent to it at premium to expand our hospital. So that property sits there paying tax. Our hospital administrator is paying taxes on it. He has lost any ability because of the zoning to use it for another reason. And it's an asset that's valueless every bit as much as Lucas. The postmortem to Lucas is that the government changed the rule. They reacquired the property. They sold it. And guess what got built? A vacation home bigger than the two on either side. So therefore, this is the maze we're in the middle of, and we're looking for our checkpoints. I think the district court believed that the job of the judge was rational basis only. They were the checkered flag at the end of the race. We believe there were checkpoints, and we've articulated what they are, and we thank you, Your Honors, for their time.
Thank you, Mr. Ostake. Your case is under submission, as are all of